what matters most to these car companies is making money and not corporate social responsibility. It's not about, you know, do we make the cleanest cars, the cars that harm society and humans the least? Because don't forget, these are emissions which can help cause asthma, COPD. So these are actually health issues. It's not just about, which can be bad enough, the environment. It's also about how human health is affected.
Follow the money.
It was the big scandal in 2015, Dieselgate. Volkswagen sold millions of cars with built-in software that made the cars look way cleaner than they really were. But Volkswagen was not the only car maker pushing the limits. In 2021, the European Union fined several car makers for colluding to limit how well their diesel cars reduce toxic emissions. And now, through a rare insight into corporate emails, Follow the Money journalist Peter Teffer found out that this kind of coordination may have started way earlier than the period they were fined for. I'm your host, Emma, and this is the podcast of the investigative newsroom Follow the Money. Welcome, Peter. Thank you for joining me.
For this story, you went back into the email archives and you found emails dating back from 2006 that got your attention. What exactly did you find in those emails?
So these were emails that were circulated in 2006 between car companies that we know from later date were seen by the European Commission as colluding. And so that's why it caught my interest, because it is rare to have an inside look in how corporations discuss what they do. Here at Follow the Money, me and several of my colleagues, we use access to documents requests a lot, which gets you documents from EU institutions, for example, or governments. But to see how corporations are communicating, that law doesn't work. So either you have a mole on the inside, or in this case, you get access to those emails because they are filed as evidence in court. And that's what happened here. Since a few years, there's a court case in the United Kingdom, in London, in the High Court. And documents that have been presented as evidence can be made available upon request. And like the first set of documents I got, there were about 100. And within them were these emails from Daimler, Volkswagen, discussing what would later be known as a cartel.
And what were they forming a cartel for? What were they discussing in these emails?
So this has to do with quite a technical thing. To make your cars as clean as possible, you can use certain technology to filter the emissions, the toxic emissions that come out of a car, like nitrous oxides, NOx. And at the time, they were discussing how to use this particular technology in a way that there was some consistency among the competitors. The thing was that you could use the technology to make cleaner cars or less clean cars beyond what the EU emissions regulations required.
Everything you've told me so far sounds a lot like Dieselgate, a big scandal in 2015. But just to be clear, this is not the same as Dieselgate, right?
No, because Dieselgate had to do with really the environmental rules being broken. And the case that we discussed just now is about competition rules.
And you have been investigating the car industry for a really long time. You also reported on Dieselgate extensively. Can you briefly remind us what Dieselgate was all about?
So Dieselgate is about car makers cheating on emissions tests before the cars are being put on the road. And what happened was that in 2015, Volkswagen was unable to explain to an American authority why their cars behaved in a certain way. The cars in the laboratory test looked very clean and were, staying below the emissions standards that the US had set. But once they were on the road, the emissions, they shot up. It was incredible. And that, it was revealed, was because there was something in the car which made the emissions filtering technique behave differently on the road and in the test.
So they were deliberately manipulating these systems.
Exactly. And they were doing this through something called legally a defeat device. And that sounds like maybe a little thingamajig, a machine in the car, but it's actually it's software or lines of software code. And those defeat devices are illegal. Mm-hmm. And car companies have used them to appear clean in the test, but in fact, when once they're on the road, they were much dirtier. And that is why in the last decades, European cities have not become cleaner in the way that European institutions expected. Because even though the emissions norms, the maximum standards, were lowered over the course of years, the pollution was not decreasing in the same amount.
What was the public reaction when this scandal came out?
Well, there was a lot of shock. And initially, it seemed in the first couple of days that this was a scandal in the US. But in fact, it was much bigger in Europe. In the US, there were about 500,000 of cars that had these defeat devices. But in Europe, if I'm not mistaken, 8 million. So it was really a European scandal. Moreover, it was not just Volkswagen whose cars were much dirtier on the road than during the test. Pretty much all diesel cars driving around in Europe were polluting much more. And this is something that I found out when I was reporting about these issues in Brussels at the time. There came out several government reports after the scandal broke, which had looked at other car companies.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, this was a question. You know, if Volkswagen has cheated, have other companies as well? Car makers knew pretty much exactly what the test was going to be. The test environment was between 20 and 30 degrees Celsius always. The test was, I think, about 20 or 21 minutes. And they knew exactly when the car would accelerate, decelerate, stop. Because these tests are being done all over Europe
mm-hmm.
by different authorities, and the lawmakers wanted to make sure that everyone did it the same way. And this is a sharp difference between how the EU and how the US has regulated car emissions. The EU does a lot of checks before the cars are being sold on the market,
mm-hmm.
While the US has a bit more of a, you know what the rules are, make sure that the cars are compliant. But in the US, they could be faced with surprise checks.
Yeah.
Whereas in the EU, that hardly happened.
So it's not a surprise that they actually found out about this scandal in the US and not in the EU?
In hindsight, no. No, this is one of the issues that the European Parliament and I myself as an investigative journalist have tried to find out. How is this scandal possible? And a lot had to do with the fact that all these authorities in Europe, they didn't feel responsible. They were all pointing to each other. The European Commission was saying, oh, it's the national authorities. The national authorities saying, oh, it's the European Commission. But this has been such a big scandal.
Yeah. So what started off as a seemingly scandal that was mainly a US thing, it became a huge thing in Europe as well. That was in 2015. Is that also when you first started following the car industry, or was it something that you had already been reporting on?
I joined this publication called EU Observer in 2014, so a year before that, and I had environment, climate, and energy in my portfolio. But I wasn't following car companies per se. It's not that I had a particular interest in car companies or even cars. I wasn't technical. I only got my driver's license when I was in my 30s. So it was just something that came on my path. So not by choice. I came a bit of an expert on all these technical issues.
Yeah, because I can imagine it's both a very technical issue, but also a legal issue. What was it like for you to do this reporting without any legal or technical background?
Yeah, I mean, I do remember spending time in the European Parliament Library simply reading the laws on EU emissions and going to these hearings. But, you know, after a while, I started hearing the same kind of terminology, and I started understanding a little bit better what happened. But even in the end, I'm still not an engineer.
Are you into cars now or still not?
No, I don't. I still couldn't care less what kind of car I'm being driven in.
So that has been over 10 years right now. And I'm wondering, what's the reason that you have been following this file for 10 years and that it kept grabbing your interest?
There's multiple reasons for that. I mean, one is that this is such a big scandal that new stuff is coming out all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It also has to do with the fact that, yeah, once in journalism you're a bit of an expert, it's sort of something that you can't escape anymore. Because, I mean, I try to remain modest, but I guess I am one of the few journalists who really understands what happened. And
you wrote an entire book on it.
I wrote a book about it. So I can put stuff into context that for other journalists is perhaps more difficult. And I can see what happened. I can remember what happened then and what happens now.
So you have your own reasons to be very interested in this topic, but it's of course not for no reason that this Dieselgate became a very, well, largely known scandal as well. But why do you think it's also important for people to care about Dieselgate and the motives of the car industry?
Well, because they all have lungs. In the end, this scandal is about air quality.
Yeah.
And about cars deciding that making money is more important than producing the cleanest cars possible. And those cars are driving around in Europe and are not helping the environment. So it doesn't matter if you drive a car yourself or whether you're left-wing or right-wing, conservative or progressive. We all breathe and the air has been more dirty in the last decades because of this scandal.
And then coming back to your latest reporting, the 2006 emails. So what were car makers doing wrong even beyond Dieselgate?
So this has to do with using a certain fluid that's pumped into the exhaust pipe, and therefore the harmful emissions are changed into less harmful. I mean, basically, the emissions are reduced. But to have this fluid in your car, you have to have a tank. And the larger the tank, the more fluid. But especially in Europe, we're very fond of smaller cars, or we have, you know, cities with not a lot of parking space. So small cars are popular. And that's why they didn't want to produce cars with a big tank. But if you don't have a big tank, then you have to have your customer go to the garage more often to fill it up, etc. So they said, okay, you know, we could make the tank smaller and then adjust how we use the technology in filtering the emissions. What that meant in practice, the European Commission concluded, was that they were producing cars that were not as clean as they could have been. And so they were not competing on environmental advantages. And that was against against EU competition rules. Now, the European Commission, in the end, ended with a settlement with these companies. So the starting point, according to the European Commission's settlement decision on the cartel, was 2009. That's why I thought it was interesting that there was these emails from 2006 that were discussing in detail how are you going to use the technology. We were having discussions, et cetera, et cetera. I can maybe quote from one of the emails. They were talking about we would have to clarify before the authorities how we use this technology. And there was one line where they discussed the size of the tank. A quote, "No one wants to report the true motivation to the authorities."
And these are emails from 2006.
Yeah.
And so, when you saw these emails, you were like, well, that sounds like some illegal activity, collusion was already going on.
It is difficult for me, it's even impossible as a journalist to say it was illegal or not. But this expert I spoke to explained that, you know, when you have a settlement, the duration of the offense can also be part of the discussions.
Yeah.
And it's possible that the European Commission did not feel confident enough to say, you know, 2006 is a clear starting point. This is a clear evidence or not.
So basically, to be sure that the settlement was at least on the table, they sort of chose the safe option.
That's a theory that you can conclude. I mean, the Commission doesn't want to comment officially on why they acted the way they did, but that's what all the available evidence sort of points to.
So, and if you were to forget about the technical details of the story, about the difficult details of the tank, for example, what does this story about the collusion really come down to for you?
It comes down to that what matters most to these car companies is making money and not corporate social responsibility. It's not about, you know, do we make the cleanest cars, the cars that harm society and humans the least? Because don't forget, these are emissions which can help cause asthma, COPD. So these are actually health issues. It's not just about, which can be bad enough, the environment. It's also about how human health is affected.
What were the consequences that these car makers faced as a result of having committed this, fraud, I think?
So Volkswagen has had to pay, I think about, the latest figure I saw was 30 or 31 billion euros in fines and settlements.
Mm.
Other companies have also had to pay some fines and settlements in a lesser degree. And there is currently the court case happening in the UK. There are also still civil proceedings, which often lead to settlements between car owners and car companies. So this is a legacy that they are still struggling with.
Because when I'm a car owner and I have a car that potentially has that malicious software, can I also claim money, rights?
In some jurisdictions, you can. It kind of depends on which country. But in the Netherlands, for example, there has been some mass claim suits, which resulted in car owners having the right to some compensation. The UK case is about that as well. There have been more than 1 million car owners who collectively sued these companies and are hoping to get some kind of compensation for it. Because in the end, they bought a car which was not as clean as it was promised, and which did not, this is what they claim, a car which has not followed the EU regulations on environment. It's important to say that all these car companies currently on trial deny these allegations.
Okay. And so we have already talked about, air quality having been affected by this scandal, of course, the consumers. But would you also say that if we put it in a broader context of the green transition, that car makers have really failed in their responsibility in this transition rather than really focusing on becoming more emission friendly, making cars that are more technologically savvy, perhaps the focus was somewhat on tricking the system instead of really innovating those products then?
Car makers have spent a lot of energy in making sure they could produce diesel cars for as long as they can, even though we know that fossil fuels in themselves should be phased out if we want to avoid the worst of climate catastrophes. But if you look at the developments over the past years, for much longer than, for example, China, European car companies have been sort of holding on to diesel as something that they want to produce. Because, I mean, it is difficult for a car maker to simply switch from producing diesel cars to electric vehicles. I'm not an economist or an expert on that, but I have read the articles saying, you know, if only they started developing their electric vehicles sooner instead of focusing on diesel, perhaps they could have stayed in the race with Chinese companies.
Yeah, so it almost sounds like instead of focusing on making that difficult transition, they focused on how to trick the system as efficiently as possible.
Yeah, I mean, difficult to make broad generalizations like that, but that's a conclusion that I've heard people say. Yeah.
And if we've consistently seen this behavior by the car industry tricking the system, what has the response been from the EU authorities? And have these scandals changed the relationship between EU authorities and car makers?
That's a great question. Car makers traditionally have a prominent seat at the table when it comes to drafting EU legislation.
Yeah.
And what I noticed in the first couple of years after Dieselgate, that it did seem like some member states and some groups in the European Parliament were less available to, you know, take requests from the car makers into consideration. But some years later, you could already see that car makers were able to convince member states that actually emission standards or CO2 reduction standards were too strict and should be watered down. Last year, you saw what they called an automotive package coming out from the European Commission saying, you know, these CO2 standards are maybe a bit too strict. Car companies are in competition with other continents in the world. We should help our companies to compete. Competitiveness has become a lot more important in the EU political debate than for example, environmental concerns. And last year, I interviewed somebody who attended a lot of these meetings organized by the European Commission, but with lots of car makers present to discuss like detailed technical implementation of laws. And he said, even right after Dieselgate, I didn't see a lot of difference. All they were doing was delaying tactics, asking questions where you kind of knew that they were just doing it to make sure that they can just postpone as much as possible new stricter laws on the environment. And also these documents, they also give some insight into how car makers were preparing for questions from authorities. There's one document where the lawyer said, this is why we are suing the companies. And there is a car company preparing for a meeting with French authorities in 2018. And the quote is, "We don't lie, but we don't have to say everything." And it gives you an idea that internally, you know, they will do, you know, the bare minimum, what is necessary, but they're never going to, you know, completely admit what they did wrong.
Recently, we have actually seen that indeed those emission reduction targets have been delayed again by the European Parliament. Was that then sort of again giving in to the wishes of the car industry?
It seems like it, yeah.
Why do they have such a prominent seat at the table still, even after all these scandals?
Well, car makers are large employers. Yeah. Right? They have quite a lot of people who are working for them, especially in Germany, which is the largest and arguably most powerful member state in the European Union, but also in France and Italy. Several Eastern European countries have a lot of factories where people are working. So this argument of, you know, do not make too strict environmental rules because it would cost jobs, that's something that's very powerful.
Yeah.
And politicians are very prone to act on that. For example, the minister president of the German state of Lower Saxony is also on the supervisory board of Volkswagen. So there are also personal ties there.
In having researched the car industry for 10 years right now, what has been the most shocking aspect for you?
I mean, the amount of trickery that's being employed and the extent to which they managed to convince authorities that they're right. Like a key example is this issue of defeat devices being there to protect the engine. I could already, with you know, no legal knowledge, conclude that this is fishy. But nevertheless, the authority said, "Oh, you know, okay, we can't do anything because it's an exception in the law." And then 5 years later, the Court of Justice said, "No, this is nonsense. Of course, you can give these companies fines if they do not produce the best clean cars compared to the technology they have, because it's clear that the law is there to help the environment.
Yeah,
it is not there to make sure that you have a car that's clean in the test laboratory.
Yeah,
it's to make sure it's clean on the road, but." You know, for decades, the car companies have acted, oh, we just thought that we had to finish the test.
It's a bit like high school students knowing exactly the right thing to pass the exam without really studying the topic in itself.
This is an analogy that I've made several times. it seems like the car makers are students that are only interested in getting the test. And they know the questions to the test, in fact.
Yeah.
But they're not interested in becoming experts and reading the entire book.
All right. Well, that's where we'll leave it for today's episode. Thank you very much for joining me, Peter. And we look forward to your next article on the car industry.
I'm afraid I'm never going to get rid of the topic.
You've listened to the podcast of Follow the Money. Our watchdog journalism is funded by our members. Subscribe and support European investigative journalism.